You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge in their complete lineup of knives and game processing kits. These guys right now are doing an absolutely huge giveaway where you could win an elk hunt, and not just any elk hunt. We're talking about a 7 or 8 mile horseback ride into the backcountry. We're talking a one-on-one guided hunt. You're going to be sleeping in a wall tent, and you're going to be doing that for 5 days with the founder and CEO of Outdoor Edge, David Block. Now, if you've never been on an elk hunt before, I'm telling you right now, go sign up for this, because if you ever hear a elk bugle, whether it's at 400 yards or it's at 40 yards, it is a life-changing experience. So here's how you enter. Go to OutdoorEdge.com. There's going to be a big banner for it somewhere on their homepage. All you have to do is click on that. Go fill out some information. I think your name, your email address, maybe some other stuff. And that's all you have to do. That's how you are entered. They're going to be picking a winner, a ways from now. So you have plenty of time to enter. Go visit OutdoorEdge.com. Sign up today. And if you decide to purchase any products from the website, enter the discount code NATION30. That's the word NATION with the number 30 after that. No spaces. NATION30. And you will receive 30% off your purchase. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Iowa Sportsman Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today we're going back into the vault to talk about some rut hunting strategy with my good buddy, Tom Peplinski. For those of you guys who listen to this, and for those of you who hunt Iowa, we all know it's a little warm this year. And some of the stuff that we talk about overlaps, and you might be able to use in the upcoming weeks. We do have a little bit of a cold spell coming, I think, early next week. And we have some precipitation in the forecast as well, which is probably going to help get the deer on their feet moving and the rut kind of do what the rut does as far as hunters are concerned. Now, what we have to remember is that the rut just doesn't stop because it's hot outside, right? So we have to use our head, use the best strategy and tactics that we know in order to get close to, let's say, like a bedding area or a pinch point or a good food source. One thing that I've noticed is mornings seem to be a little bit better than afternoons, but that's just the pocket that I hunt. Other than that, good luck to everybody out there hunting the rut, that's currently hunting the rut, and who's getting ready to take their vacation and get out and spend a lot of time in the tree stand. Before we get into this throwback episode, though, I got to do a little commercial from our partners over at Quiet Cat. Now, electric bikes are the hottest thing out right now. Quiet Cat is the leader in electric bikes for hunting, fishing, camping, and exploring the great outdoors. Get to your stand quietly and scent-free, and bring all of your gear with you without breaking a sweat. Quiet Cat features accessories such as cargo trailers, racks, bags, backpacks, bow and gun holders, as well as lights for safe travel anytime. For more information about Quiet Cat, visit quietcat.com. All right, there's your commercial. Let's get into this rut throwback discussion with Tom Peplinski.
Well, it's a completely different scenario.
Yep.
The last time we talked, we were talking about the onset to when does are coming in the heat. And now we are literally talking about the does are coming in the heat. The majority of the does will be bred, and then the tail end. So it's a completely different, in theory, it's a completely different range of obstacles and hunting methods and you name it.
All right.
The deer woods is no longer the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one thing where I like the rut. I love the rut. Everybody loves the rut, but there's also a disadvantage to the rut because there is this chaos where these deer that you may once have thought, you know, hey, maybe they're patterned, they're no longer patterned. You know, it just takes one doe to take them 2 miles down the road, right?
That's correct. And we also know, at least you know, I would propose that a mature buck's home range can triple or quadruple in size during this time frame. So if you had a pattern on a buck in that late October, early November time frame, that pattern is probably blown out. It's probably gone. You should probably not necessarily be hunting that pattern anymore. And if you're hunting individual deer, this gets very difficult because that home range expands. So like I said earlier, it's completely different atmosphere in the deer woods right now because there's does coming into heat and they are calling all the shots.
Absolutely. All right, so let's start talking about it. And this is a very vague question, and I want you to answer it from, I guess, both the standpoint of someone who may have their own property and have food plots and whatnot to the guy who maybe is hunting public. And I think some of the answers you're going to give can probably, go to both the public and private land question. But it's November 8th. What should we be doing right now to put ourselves in the best position for this peak rut?
Okay. So the first thing you should just to kind of recap a little bit is if we're into that November 8th time frame, we are in the part of that bell curve when does are getting bred where, 80% of the does in the herd are going to be bred in this time frame coming up starting right now, November 8th. So the first thing we should be doing is in large part abandoning this, I think I can pattern this mature buck. He's on this specific bed to feed pattern. He's been here for the last 3 weeks and I'm going to go in there and get him. So that the first thing we need to do is recognize where we're at and maybe abandon some of those successful methods that we had earlier in the season and recognize where we're at right now.
Right.
With that being said, in general terms, a very successful way to approach this November time frame when these does are getting bred is to look for this is basically how I hunt this time frame in general terms. For morning hunts, I'll hunt travel areas like fence jumps, maybe there's fence openings, classic funnels, timbered points. I touched on timbered points last time when we talked. And really, one of the most successful places to hunt this time of year is the downwind side of a doe bedding area.
Right.
So basically getting off of food sources, getting back into some cover, using the wind to your advantage. Even when you're hunting these travel corridors, fence jumps, whatever, make sure the wind's in your favor. And basically trying to hunt cover and points and funnels between cover. Get in there early and sit as long as you can.
Okay.
And then the simple strategy is at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, if you can sit that long, get down, maybe grab a bite to eat, go to the bathroom quick, and then hop right back in the stand and finish your day out closer to a food source.
Gotcha.
That's a pretty sound strategy for everybody. That's even public land.
Right.
Private, public, it doesn't matter. You're hunting cover in the morning, the downwind side of a doe bedding area, things like that. And then you're just transitioning over to a food source in the evening. That's been a pretty solid game plan for me.
Right.
This time of year.
So let's break those locations out, right? So you have your travel corridors, and those travel corridors are more than likely, depending on wind direction, going to be the same between the bed to food, right? So the does are still going to be on some sort of a bed to feed pattern throughout the entire rut. It's just that the does or the bucks may kick them off that a little bit, but they're still, going to a bed and then they're trying to get back to a food source back and forth, right? So let's break these down. And first, let's just start off with the main one, which is down bed or downwind of a doe bedding area. In your experiences, what does that look like? What is downwind of a doe bedding area look like?
So does typically, and I can only use generalities because every farm is different. The habitat is different where everybody hunts, but does and fawns typically like to bed, in my experience, as close as they can to where they're eating. So if they have a food source and a water source, and they have a brushy draw, maybe you've done some habitat management, and you've hinge cut some pockets of trees around a food plot, something like that. Even on public land, if you're hunting public land and there's still some standing crops or some cut corn that hasn't gotten too much hunting pressure, those does and fawns, if they can, are going to bed as close as they can to that food source. So it's really the thickest, most advantageous spot for a deer to bed as close as they can to a food source. And then if you can get on the downwind side of that, those bucks, a lot of times, instead of going into that bedding area and literally trying to sniff out every single doe that's in there, they can smell for 200 yards. On a decent day, a buck can smell for 200 yards anything that's upwind of them. So a mature buck knows that. It's not, deer aren't stupid. They know that they can smell, you know, way better than a human, but they know that if they get on a downwind side of a bedding area, if there's one doe in there or 15 does in there, it's going to be really easy for them to just go along that bedding area and be like, yep, there's a doe that's in heat in there, or there's nothing here for me, I'm on to my next one.
Right.
So, yeah, go ahead.
What do you feel is close? I know that's a relative term, but from your experience, how close are does bedding to a food source?
Well, if it's in public land and they've been pressured a lot, it might be a quarter mile. If it's on one of my two farms, it's literally adjacent to the food source. So, you know, again, it's hard for me to say, because you'll have to, you know, each hunter is going to have to use their own experience. But as a general rule of thumb, when I say as close to, I literally mean they will bed right at the food source. If the hunting pressure is low and the habitat's available there for them, they're going to bed right on it.
Gotcha.
And this is does and fawns, nubbin bucks, and maybe even year and a half old bucks that are still kind of traveling with their mother from last year.
Right.
You know, so if you're hunting private land, like on my two farms, Wayne and Decatur County, Southern Iowa, we do everything we can to limit the amount of hunting pressure that's on those does and fawns at that food source. And so they'll stay bedded right up tight next to it all year because we let them.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So find basically through, by now you should know where those bedding, you know, through scouting and through maybe doing some hunting already in the season, you should know where the food source is. And I know that changes throughout the year, but what would you say this time of year is a good food source? You know, another general question with a general answer that we should be focusing on, not necessarily sitting on that food source, but knowing where that food source is.
So this kind of goes back to a little bit of my comment earlier where you have to know to change.
Yeah.
So if you were hunting acorns earlier in the year, the chances of there being acorns left are probably slim. They're usually gone. So you've got to transition over to any available grains. So if they're standing corn or standing beans, that's still going to be a preferred food source. If it's cut corn or cut beans, you know, 20, 30 years ago, combines were way less efficient, and a cut bean and cut corn field would maybe last for 2 or 3 weeks after they were cut. And today, it's just not so much.
Right.
So if a corn field comes off, you're looking at, you know, 5-10 days to me at most, if it's a modern combine, and any kind of grain that was on the ground is going to be gone because they just don't leave anything. And still, a lush alfalfa field, a clover food plot, these green type food sources, my favorite is a lush alfalfa field, are still going to be good until they've taken some really, really heavy frost. And this time of year, you know, it's kind of you're flipping a coin. You don't know if you're going to get those really heavy frosts or not, but you know, a lush alfalfa field is going to draw a lot of deer until it's completely frozen out. So that's what I would really key in on are your grain crops, any kind of standing beans and corn, cut beans and corn, but only if it's, you know, recent. And then, you know, lush alfalfa and clover. And then, you know, if you're planting food plots, you know, that's, you have other, you know, green food plots like winter rye and wheat and, you know, guys that are planting brassicas and stuff like that. But really the grain crops and alfalfa really take over this time of year if they're available.
Right. So kind of taking a backward step now to go back to this doe bedding area and hunting on the downwind side of it. Let's say you locate this and it's before the season. Do you ever put multiple stands, or do you tear up and set down a lot on this particular bedding area based off the wind direction?
So it could be both. There's a lot of places on my farms where I'll have three tree stands, and you can darn near see each tree stand from the other. And that's a specific movement I'm talking about, this downwind of a doe bedding area. And you want to be able to hunt it with a north wind. Maybe you want to be able to hunt it with a southeast wind, or, you know, different wind scenarios. So I'll have three tree stands all within, you know, 70, 80 yards of each other.
Right.
I'm on private land. All my stands are hung, generally speaking, 90% of my stands are hung, you know, the spring before. I'm hanging them in March and April. And maybe I'll have to move one, maybe I'll have to add one, but usually not so much. Usually they're in there. There's an occasion where a food source will change and I'll pick up on a pattern where does are bedding in a different spot or bucks are moving in a different spot, and I'll quick hang a stand. But that's on private land, it's a lot easier because you've learned the deer herd, you've been there for a while. So a lot of these stands are there year to year, and then you're just, you know, you're going back in and making sure they're safe and the shooting lanes and stuff are cut out of them. But I'm typically not hanging stands this time of year.
Okay. Right. So now you mentioned downwind of a doe bedding area. This is a preferred morning hunt for you?
Yeah. Yeah. So if I can get in, so in other words, again, going back to March and April, I'm picturing myself, okay, this is November 10th. And I want to get into this spot. Deer are going to be bedded here. I want to be on the downwind side. So maybe I'm going to plan a stand out for a west wind, for example. So I'm going to want to come in from the east if I can, because the wind's out of the west. So the wind's in my face. I want to be able to sneak up into that stand and hunt there as long as I can take it. So whether that's I have to get out because I have to go to the bathroom, or my back is killing me, or whatever, but I want to stay in that stand as long as I possibly can and then get out. And then transition over to more something that's food. Because bucks are going to, in the evening, bucks know that these doe family groups are going to head out to their food sources. So typically that's where I want to be then, because that's where the bucks are going to go out seeking their next doe.
Right. So are you a proponent of sitting in certain locations all day long?
Yes, but not for me. I can't physically do it anymore. So back when I was in my 20s and teens and 30s, you know, I could climb up and have a knot in my back and the tree would be twisted and I could sit there all day. And today, not so much. I can't do it anymore. So I know this. So I plan out that, you know, I'm going to sit here till 11 o'clock in the morning, maybe one if it's a ladder stand. I'm actually transitioning a lot to these really nice, comfortable ladder stands just because of my physical ability to sit in a small hang on for that many hours.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, if you can do it and you can sit there all day on the downwind side of a bedding area, there's no reason why you have to get out. I would argue that if you can sit there till 1 p.m. or 2 p.m, it still might be a better option to get down and go seek out a preferred food source for the evening hunt. I would make that argument. But you know, if you're seeing action and it's been, you know, you look at your watch and 10 minutes ago, a doe came through and there was a 3-year-old chasing it or something. It's not like you have to get down. It's
right.
Just, it's for me, it's out of necessity. I can't do it. I just can't do it all day anymore.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. So we got our stand location. It's downwind of the doe bedding area. Would you say you're staying away from the bedding area on that downwind side so that the buck doesn't get downwind to you. You know what I mean?
So, yeah. So if you're looking at, you know, just timber, so you have thousands of acres of timber, this gets really difficult. So then it becomes a judgment call where you're going to try and find that happy medium of, I want to be close enough so when he comes through, I'm going to get a shot. But yet if I'm so close and he's farther yet away, he's not going to be, you know, downwind of me. So I get the question. For me, I'm not hunting these thousands of acres of big timber. So I'm hunting farm country where there's draws. In a big section of timber for me would be like 30 acres. You know, that would be a lot of timber, because then it's just draws and more fields and CRP and stuff like that. So a doe bedding area, you know, could be 5 acres, could be 10 acres. So for me to get on the downwind side of that doe bedding area, that might be all the cover that's in that area. So it becomes real easy, because the buck is going to just travel the downwind side. And for me, I'm right on the edge of that cover. I'm letting my scent blow out into a CRP field, or, you know, over a ditch and on some fallow ground. It's hard to explain. One of my best, I guess I could go back to one of my best setups is a draw. A draw comes from the east to the west, and then it kind of hooks back in and then follows to the south. And that's all those bucks use the draw. And as they're using that draw and the hook back to the south, they are already on the downwind side of a bedding area. So they naturally want to use that draw anyways. And the fact that there's a doe bedding area just makes it a phenomenal stand for this time of year.
Gotcha.
So it's fairly easy to hunt that, because I can get in there, not bust any deer. I'm already hunting in a travel corridor because it's a draw. And it just happens to be, oh, look at that, there's a doe bedding area on the downwind side of them if I got the right wind direction.
Right, right. So what about, you mentioned access to this spot. How aggressive do you get with your access routes to and from tree stands?
By aggressive, you mean what?
I mean, just like, because sometimes, and I know this is my circumstance, is in order for me to get to a tree stand, because I'm surrounded by, let's say there's a rectangle, right? It's laid flat. The east side of this rectangle is my entrance into the property. The west side is the tree stand, but I can't come from the north or the south, technically, because maybe the landowner hasn't given me permission, or the west side because there's a body of water or a river or something like that. And I have to go through some of the property to get to that tree stand location, and potentially, you know, at some, you know, someplace in that route, my scent may blow and spook deer.
Okay. So my answer is going to sound real snaky, but if it's me and I have to give something up, I'm going to give up my neighbor's ground. So on the scenario you just gave me, where you have to come in from the east, that's your only access, and you want to hunt the west side of your property. If it's a north wind, I'm going to come in on the south side of my property. So even though I may physically bump deer as I'm walking in on the south side of my property, all my scent is going onto the neighbor's property.
Yeah.
so as I'm walking in, I'm saying, okay, 200 yards downwind of me, I'm going to blow every deer. And if I don't blow it, they at least know that I'm there.
Right.
I want that to be my neighbor's deer.
Yeah.
So the last thing I would want to do is walk in on the east side of my farm, have to go all the way to the west with a north wind, and come on the north side of my property, where now not only am I bumping deer on the way in, I'm taking the 200 yards downwind of me, and I'm telling every deer on my property that I'm hunting you tonight. I'm here.
Right.
I'd rather tell the neighbor's deer that they're being hunted.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's something that I personally do myself. So, you know, you gotta put the odds in your favor. So when you're downwind of this bedding area and you're sitting there and waiting, do you do any types of calling in this scenario?
Typically not. I will call to a target buck. So I will never, let's say, practice call on a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or a year and a half or something like that. I don't do that. If I see a target buck and I think I can call to them, I generally will. But it's kind of like we talked about last time. It's less is more, and I don't do a lot of calling unless I feel that I'm going to have a good chance of bringing that deer in. The other thing I'll say is, if, let's say it is a deer that I'm really familiar with and I've seen them before, you know, multiple times, or, you know, let's say I have a history with this deer. He's been on my farm since he was 3 and then 4 and now he's 5. And so I see him again, I'd be less apt to call to that deer than I would be a buck that I've never seen before. And holy cow, look at that one. I might be more willing to call to that deer because that might be the first and last time I ever see that deer. If he's out of his core area, let's say he's a mile, he's expanded his home range. So now he's, instead of, you know, 400 acres or 100 acres, what he's typically using, and all of a sudden he's at 2,000 acres or 3,000 acres, and you see this guy and you've never seen him before, that would be the one I'd be more apt to try and call to, because you might not ever see him again. Right. So you don't really have a lot to lose.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So if it's a homebody buck that you have history with, the chances of you calling at him are slim.
Slimmer. Yeah. Slimmer. I'm not going to say I'm not going to do it, but you know, if I'm playing this cat and mouse game and I think I got a good chance on getting them, I might not call to him at all and just prefer to play the cat and mouse game as opposed to letting him bust me. You know, I call to him, he comes in, he gets on the dog inside and he busts me, then I feel like my chances of killing that deer out of that tree stand have just gone down. Not that it's impossible, but it just makes it that much more difficult. So that's that judgment call again.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you are looking at a buck, and I've heard this, you know, I've heard this statement, you know, you got to try to look at their body language. What is their body telling you? Are you looking, when you see a deer through your binoculars, is there anything that you're looking for in that body language that will determine whether or not you need to call at him?
No. So my guess is there's probably hunters out there that will tell you that they can do that. And I'm not saying that they can't. I'm certainly not one that would say that, you know, I can look at a deer, a buck, through my binoculars at 100 yards and I know, you know, there's a high probability that I can call to that deer or not. I would not say that I can do that.
Right.
But what I'm more looking for is the deer nervous? Has maybe he smelled where I walked in? Has a doe busted me and so the doe took off and he's like, what's going on? You know, under those kinds of scenarios, I'm never going to call to that deer.
Right.
Because if he's already nervous, you know, if he's kind of starting if you've ever seen a big buck do it, you know what I'm talking about. But it's, you know, they can be walking through the woods and not have a care in their world, nose to the ground, and you know they're just looking for a hot doe. That one I'd be more apt to try and call to. I don't care what he's doing. I don't care if he's scraping or whatever. So my distinguish is like is he not alert or is he alert? And if he's alert because he smelled me, maybe a squirrel's busted me, you know, a red squirrel lit up and is barking at me, and so now he's alert, stuff like that, then I'd be a lot less prone to call to him.
Gotcha. Do you ever have I know this is another one of those questions, but do you ever have a scenario where you're always going to call?
Yeah, I guess the one scenario would be a deer that's not spooked that I have zero history with. That would be the one scenario where in my mind I have nothing to lose, because right, the chances of ever seeing that deer again are probably very low. So I have nothing to lose at that point. So right, it's like, you know, what the other option is, you don't even try for it and then you probably never see it again. And to me, that's not very high odds. Right. So even if you think, well, maybe I'm not going to call this deer in, you'd really have nothing to lose. So that would be one scenario where I definitely would give a call. And I actually prefer antlers over grunting. Not that I won't grunt, but I've just had better luck with antlers. Of course, not when they're close. This is when they're, you know, off in the distance. But for some reason, I know a lot of people will say their progression would start with a grunt and then work up to antlers, where a lot of times I'll start with antlers. But you got to understand, that's 150 yards, you know, 200 yards, something like that.
Right, right.
If they're close and I just want to steer them, then it's a grunt call.
Right. So do you feel that calling during the rut is kind of like a secondary tactic, one that you should only use if you have to?
Well, for me, it is.
Yeah.
So I would hate to say that should be that way for everybody, because I don't want to say that should be that way for everybody. For me, it is, because my hunting methods revolve around the work that I do in the off season.
Right.
You know, whether that's food plots, transition areas, fence jumps, trying to find out, you know, these downwind sides of bedding areas and funnels. So I put all of my resources and time and effort and even money into planning out in March and April how I want to hunt in October and November.
Right.
So right. For me, it is.
Okay.
But if that's not your, if that's not your plan of attack, you know, by all means, maybe calling is your ticket. You know, I'm not saying that's not, there is no right or wrong way with hunting. That's just my preferred method is more the habitat and, you know, what I call like landscape manipulation, where I try and manipulate the deer to do what I want them to do. But I'm doing that back in March.
Right. Right.
So,
well, and I'm kind of the opposite. Like, yes, I do try to set trail cameras up and stuff, but I, on the other hand, I don't have the ability to plant food plots. My property that the property that I hunt or that I spend most of my time on is a piece of private ground, but I don't plant food plots. I don't have the ability to manipulate the property, but still I feel that calling is a secondary tactic, because the utmost goal of hunting is to get into the position where you can shoot a deer without having to do that tactic.
Yep. And for you, that makes perfect sense.
Yep. Absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, I used to hunt with a guy. I was good friends with him. We just kind of went separate ways over the years, like you do sometimes with friends. And I swear that guy could call in a buck with a kitchen sink. I mean, the guy was just, you know, it was almost laughable. The way the guy could call in deer was, and I would just shake my head. Like, how is that possible that you could do that? You know?
Right.
But me, that's not, I'm just on the other end of the spectrum. So I know that. So I guess I have two choices when it comes to calling. Either do it more and try and get better at it, or accept the fact that maybe I'm not good at it, or whatever the case may be. But the other thing with calling, and this is kind of in general terms, is for me, my hunting strategy is, if something works for me, I try to do that more. I try to multiply the amount of things that work for me and just repeat those things. And if they don't work for me, well, then I kind of try to abandon them.
Right.
So what has worked for me are the habitat type things and making sure the tree stands in the right spot and kind of learning the deer behavior and where they bed and where they feed, as opposed to the calling. So that's just what I fall back on, is what works for me.
Right. Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the, I guess, method that needs to be spread, is you got to do what works for you. And that's one thing that not only on this podcast, but every other podcast that I'm on, you talk about, just because my strategy or your strategy works for you, that's because you or we don't hunt their property. They don't hunt our property. Yeah, some principles, you can probably take away the principles of what we're talking about and apply it, but you got to do what's right on your property. And if it is sitting on a field edge and rattling, and that's how you found success, man, I say continue to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And then I would just add one sentence to that, that if on your property, you're sitting on a field edge and you're rattling, and you're on year 7 and 8 and 9 and 10, and you still haven't rattled one in, you might want to consider not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
Because the opposite is true. Because I do know hunters that repeat what they do year after year after year, and they're not successful.
Right.
Well, then in that case, you should change. You should do something different, because it's not working for you.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we talked a little bit about calling. We're kind of all over the place with this one, but I think all the information is good. But we've talked about the doe bedding area. What about the pinch point? Because I feel I love to hunt pinch points, but I love to hunt pinch points when I don't have a read on a buck, if that makes sense.
So, yeah, so early, and I know I'm jumping back into the early season. We're not talking about that, but I feel like I have to because it makes sense to me. So early in October, before these bucks are really getting out of their core areas and they're expanding their home ranges, hunting a funnel type area, pinch point, whatever you want to call them, probably isn't the greatest technique in the world because these bucks are on their bed to feed and feed to bed pattern. And unless they're actually using that pinch point or that fence jump, you're just wasting your time. There's no, that the whole purpose of that pinch point or that fence jump, or when I'm making a fence and leaving a gate opening, is when these bucks have now exploded their home ranges because they're looking for the next available doe and they're getting out of their core areas and they're now at, you know, 2,000 acres or 3,000 acres in range and they're just putting on miles. That's when these become effective because it's just a matter of time before they work out that draw or they come through that gate opening or they travel out a timbered point over a ridge and down to the next timbered point because it's an easy travel route for them, or they cross a ridge top through a saddle. That's when these become effective, when the deer are putting on miles. And so that's this time of year. And so you're 100% right. If you have a pattern on a buck, there's no reason to sit a pinch point or a fence jump because you already have a pattern on that buck.
Right.
If you're not hunting a specific buck, but you're just more hunting a time of year, it's November 7th or November 8th, and you know these bucks are going to be out looking for the next available hot doe, that's the time to get into those spots where you're not necessarily hunting this one big 10-pointer you got eyes on. You might be hunting any mature buck, and it might be a buck that comes from 1,000 acres over from one of your neighbor's farms that is going to come through your property, walk through your pinch point, and then that's when you're going to get a shot. I think that makes sense to me. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's almost like out of all of the locations that can be identified, like, so for me, there's the bedding area, there's the travel route, there's the staging area, and there's the food source in what we would call a bed to feed routine. Now, sometimes, you know, the travel corridor could go through one of these big pinch points, but I'm looking at a map of my property right now. And yes, a couple does do use it and some smaller bucks. And I only know this because I have a trail camera in this pinch point and there's no mature buck movement through it right now. However, historical data tells me that as October starts to wind down and November starts to wind up, more big bucks start using this pinch point because, like you said, their home range is expanding. And that's when you'll get the, what some people call a bonus buck show up, right? The bucks that don't ever, like, where did he come from? He's going to show up in one of these pinch points because he's cruising the farm, right? So those are the spots that that particular spot is where I go to, where after I maybe hit all my downwind of my doe bedding areas and there's nothing showing up, I check my trail cameras, there's no mature bucks or hitless bucks in the area, I go sit one of these pinch points or these really big travel corridors just to, it's almost like it's something to sit while the rest of the property has time to cycle through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. One thing I do want to point out is when I'm saying a buck's home range expands, I don't want to give the illusion that a buck has, and I'm making these numbers up because I think it's different depending on whether it's big timber or ag. In fact, science shows that it is different. But, you know, on one of my farms, let's say a buck's core range in the summertime and in the fall is 40 acres. And I say that because in some cases that's actually what it is by me. It's like 40 acres, 60 acres. There'll be a 5-year-old buck and that's all he's using. When I say they expand their home range, their home range has always been, you know, that 2,000 acres. It's just they're not using it.
Right.
So when I say they're expanding their home range, what I should be saying really is they're expanding the usage of their home range, whereas they're not using 90% of their home range. They're not using except for like three weeks of the year for them. And this is the time. This is the time of year where if they're not with a hot doe in their core area, there's a high likelihood that they're going to be, you know, walking out some fence lines and out some draws and onto the neighbor's property, and they're going to be looking. But it's all within their home range.
Right.
Now, I think there are some examples of bucks making these excursions where they, you know, they travel 8 miles and stuff. And, you know, I'm not really talking about that because I have no, you know, even a buck that has a small home range the entire year during these 2 or 3 weeks, they're going to get out and they're going to explore the rest of their home range and look for the next available doe. And that's when these funnels and pinch points and timber draws and, you know, I've said it before, that's when they become hot.
Right. Absolutely. All right. So after a buck finds a doe, he hooks back up with her. And from my experience, I feel like they go into a pattern again, right? They, for me, it's like I'm using a buck from like 2 or 3 years ago that I feel he was on this basically scrape route where I'd have him down on this field edge at like real late at night, and then on this other pinch point early morning, and then I'd have him daylight on this. So he's making this big circle around the farm until he finds runs into another hot doe. He hooks up with her again. So do you feel that after a buck leaves, like goes and breeds a doe and he splits from her, that he kind of goes back onto a pattern again?
I guess I don't know what I believe. What I believe is they want to breed every doe that they possibly can breed. In general terms, I think that's what's going on. And so when they find a doe, it's her pattern that they basically take on. So if she has a bed to feed pattern or a feed to bed pattern for that 24 hours or whatever that breeding takes place over, he's going to assume her pattern, because he's going to be with her. That's how I view it. And maybe that's not 100% accurate, but that's how I view it.
Right.
And as soon as she's done being bred and he's done with that doe, I don't know that it's kind of like this joke that people guys say, you know, they're really concentrated on something. And then all of a sudden squirrel, you know, right. Then all of a sudden their attention's on that squirrel. I actually think that's how a deer is. I don't know that deer think like we do. We want them to think like we do, because then it's easier for us to understand what their next move is.
Right.
I don't think it works that way. I think they're kind of like my dog. He's got an attention span of about 10 seconds. And so when a buck is done breeding, he just goes and he looks for the next available doe. And if somebody slams a car door, well, now he's heading east. And then and then all of a sudden, somebody fires up a tractor or a combine. Oh, now he's heading south. And I don't think he necessarily has a plan. That's just my opinion. I don't know during this time of year if a deer has it all figured out in their head. I just don't think they do. I think it's just completely random. They're looking for the next available doe, and a car door slamming or them busting a hunter. So they're in their travels, all of a sudden they get down with a hunter. Well, now they're not headed this direction anymore. Now they went back the other way. You know what I'm saying? So it's so random that your best bet is just to put as much time as you possibly can in the woods and just be out there.
Right. How much time do you give an area with nothing showing up before you move on to a next one, the next area?
Well, if it's a known, for me, if it's a known, what do I want to say? If it's a fence jump, and I know I'm repeating myself a little bit here, but if it's a fence jump, an opening, or one of these classic funnels or a timbered point, if I sit there, you know, two mornings, if I get the right wind and I sit there two mornings and I don't see a deer, that doesn't mean I won't go back there for a third or a fourth.
Right.
If it's a, if it's a food plot. So let's say I'm assuming this 20 acre lush alfalfa field is the preferred feeding pattern. So I'm getting down at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm getting a quick bite to eat. Maybe I'm taking another quick shower and I'm getting out on this food source. And I have several different stands or different winds on this food source. If it's a food source type scenario and I sit it once or twice and there's nothing coming out there, well, then I'm wrong. Then it's like, that's not a preferred food source anymore. You know, if it's cut corn, maybe all the corn's gone. So in that case, I'll abandon very quickly. And I'm like, okay, I'm wrong here. What do I got to do? What's the preferred food source? So then I'll try and figure that out. Maybe the next day I only hunt till 10 o'clock and I'll spend a couple hours in the truck driving around trying to find out where are these deer? Oh, there's this corn here is still standing. There's a cut bean field here there's a bean field here that's not cut yet. And so maybe I'll try and in my mind figure out, okay, the deer aren't on the east side of my property. They're on the north side of my property, or they're in one of my food plots.
Right. Right. Okay. So it just, man, that's the crazy thing. There's so many variables during the rut. It's hard to, you know, give a strategy that works. And I think the most important thing for people to understand is that you have to be able to, like, be able to observe your surroundings and make a decision based off of what your surroundings and the deer are telling you.
You have to adapt.
You're right.
You have, like I said earlier about the calling. If you're on that field edge and you're rattling and calling for 10 years and you never get one, you have to change. The same goes for in season. You have to be able to adapt. If you were counting on a certain food source, for example, to be a preferred food source, and it's not, you know, you have two choices. You can either adapt and try and find a different food source, or you can dig your heels in and just say, oh, this is it. This is where I'm hunting. And in the latter, you're probably not going to be too successful.
Right.
So you have to be able to adapt in season. But at the same time, there's that fine line being the guy that jumps all over the place because they think that they're being adaptable, and the guy that's patient enough to recognize that they're really not doing anything wrong. This is a good travel core, or this is a good food source. I just need to be a little bit patient here. There's a fine line between the two.
Right. Right. So any other rut tips, tricks, or tactics that we need to talk about?
The only thing that I would say, and this is, it's fairly new for me, so I'm not even going to say that it's an excellent tactic, but I think it's on the border of being hilariously fun to do, and that's a decoy.
Okay.
I've only been doing this for like the last 5-6 years, and I'll even admit that I'm not even so sure that it's the most effective tactic, because you do seem to disturb the deer. The deer are pretty what do I want to say? They're tense, and a lot of times you get busted, but it is so fun. When you can use a buck decoy and bring a mature buck in and have them peel their ears back and their hair stands up on their back and you get to shoot them. And I've had a couple opportunities where it's worked for me on an evening hunt. It's, even if it's not the most effective tactic out there, I still love it because it's fun. It is very exciting to see a mature buck at 200 yards could care less about where you're at, and you got that decoy out and you just tickle the antlers together or grunt to get him to see that decoy, and he comes in from 200 yards away with that body posture. That to me is like the peak of excitement on a deer hunt.
Right.
For archery.
Right. You know, that's a tactic that I tried several years ago. When I mean several, I mean like right when I started seriously getting into hunting, like 2007-08. Then I became more mobile in my hunting style and just stopped decoying, because having to take a decoy wherever I went on top of my tree stand on my back and holding my bow and potentially sometimes a pole saw, it just became overwhelming. So the decoy got the chop as, you know, and most of my hunts are in cover, right? I very rarely hunt field edges because, like, you know, like, I don't have food plots to hunt. Field edges for me just means that you're kind of, I don't know. I don't know. I just know that I'm not a big fan of hunting field edges when I don't have to.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And when I'm using my decoy, it's all fields. It's all, right. You know, I got my back up to some CRP, some 7 foot tall switchgrass, and I got like an acre of clover out in front of me. And so I can put that decoy out. And then any deer that comes out sees that decoy. And because I'm hunting private land, my land, at the end of the night or whatever, I just take the decoy and I put it in my blind. And so to me, it's not the hassle of trying to pack a decoy in a half a mile on public land or something.
Right.
But yeah, I absolutely see that.
All right. So the next question I have, and it's one of the last ones here for this podcast, but any rut no-nos?
Any rut no-nos? Well, I will say this. I don't know if it's a rut no-no, but I will say this. A lot of times, and I've done it myself, I've seen it happen to me. It's happened to many of my friends. It happens to one of my friends every single year. And that's kind of a condition that I call like rut anxiety or hunting anxiety, where for 9, 10, 11 months, there's this buildup where, you know, we're doing food plots or we're scouting and we're watching YouTube videos and we're listening to podcasts and deer hunting shows. And so it's like our rut. So as a human, we're just primed and ready to go. And October 1st comes and we're just pounding her and we're hunting and we're hunting and we're hunting and we're not seeing nothing. And all of a sudden it gets to be November 1st and 2nd and 3rd. And all of a sudden this panic sets in that we're not going to get a deer and everything's going wrong. And so we start taking shortcuts. So we don't take, and I'm a kind of a big scent guy as far as wind direction. I'm a big scent guy, but not necessarily like keeping my scent to a minimum. But if you are, I see guys that'll quit taking showers, maybe a doe they got out 3 days ago, blood is still on their hunting clothes, instead of walking, you know, half a mile out of the, so if they know that's the best way in, they walk right straight to it and bump out a bedding area because it's this laziness, or I don't know what you want to call it, because the season's dragged on and now it's starting to wear on them.
Right.
They're not seeing deer. Things aren't working out right. So they start taking shortcuts, and it's not like they're thinking, I'm going to take a shortcut today or I don't care today. It's just that it beats them down, and then pretty soon they're making mistakes and they don't even know they're making mistakes. It's simply because it's wearing them down, and they're on week 5 and week 6. And I think that hurts more hunters than people realize.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you there, man. And I've been guilty of that several times before. I don't know. One thing that I want to say as far as a rut no-no would be, do not ever call at a deer that's busted you. I don't know. I think it was like 2011 or 12 or something like that. I had this gigantic, like 185 typical 12 coming right at me. I don't know whether he caught my ground scent or caught, or the wind shifted and he caught a scent of me, but he stopped in his track. He turned around, he started walking away, and I ended up grunting at him. I rattled at him. I threw the snort wheeze at him, everything. And I never saw that buck again, the rest of the rut on trail camera. So it's like, he just stood up, or he heard all that stuff and then he left. So I learned my lesson the hard way on that one. Don't call to a deer that's already busted you. Go locate him again. So,
yeah, I think that's all season. All season. Yeah, don't call the deer that know you're there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Tom, man, I really appreciate you again hopping on, talking about the rut tactics with us, and hopefully, if you haven't had, if you don't have one on the ground by now, you do in the next couple weeks, man.
Yeah, right back at you. And to everybody else out there, just hang in there. The best hunting is, I'm probably not the best hunting in my opinion, but some very, very good hunting is upon us on this peak breeding period. So stay in a tree. Be safe.
And that's the perfect way to end the podcast, is to be safe. And if you do want to be successful, it's just tree stand time. Time to put in the work. Time to grind. Get out there. Sit in a tree stand or a ground blind as much as possible. Play the wind. Follow the strategies that we talked about today. And I'm sure you will eventually get a crack at something. I don't know what, but something. And man, thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you guys for continuing to tune in and support this podcast. If you haven't already, go to iowasportsman.com and take a look at, there's a lot of great information on the website as well. And you need to subscribe to the magazine, because this podcast only touches a hair of what is in the magazine and a hair of what is on the website. So go get a subscription to the magazine, and that could be found on the website as well. Enough talking. It's time to get back to the tree, grind it out the rest of November. Good luck and stay safe.